We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD2. We're streaming online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. So glad you could be with us today. Our guest this afternoon in this portion of the program is psychologist Stephen Hinshaw. He joins us to talk about what he calls the triple bind facing adolescent girls. One, be good at all of the traditional girl stuff. Two, be good at most of the traditional guy stuff. And three, conform to a narrow, unrealistic set of standards that allows for no alternative. In other words, be pretty, sweet, and nice. Be athletic, be competitive, and get straight A's, and be impossibly perfect. Stephen Hinshaw, who chairs the Department of Psychology at the University of California, Berkeley, is the author, together with Rachel Kranz, of the book The Triple Bind, Saving Our Teenage Girls from Today's Pressures. Dr. Hinshaw says girls today have many opportunities to succeed. He duly notes that women have made great strides in all walks of life. But the pressures on girls to succeed in so many areas of life are taking a toll, a high toll. He says at least one quarter of American girls are suffering from self-mutilation, eating disorders, significant depression or serious consideration of suicide, or are perpetrating acts of physical violence. He says this is a crisis. In addition to heading the Department of Psychology at UC Berkeley, Stephen Hinshaw is a clinical professor in the Department of Psychiatry at UC San Francisco. The Triple Bind, Saving Our Teenage Girls from Today's Pressures, is published by Ballantine Books. Dr. Hinshaw, hello, how are you?
I'm very good, and thanks for having me on.
Oh, my pleasure. 25% of girls are in immediate danger. Self-mutilation, eating disorders, violence, depression. Where does that statistic come from?
This comes from the best national survey data and clinical data we have. Now, we've known for a long time that if we're talking about mental health problems that occur in the first 10 years of life, these are mainly boy problems. Boys are at higher risk than girls for attention deficit disorder, autism, aggressive conduct problems. We've also known for some time that right in the early teen years, as puberty hits and as all the teen pressures begin, girls rise in risk for the adolescent problems of eating disorders, depression, anxiety. But what's different is that within the last 10 years, the risk that girls have in adolescence for mental health problems has dramatically risen, so that we now have a virtual epidemic of cutting behavior, self-harm, self-mutilation. The national data on binge eating and other eating disorders have shown rises in the last 10 years for these problems in girls. The last year for which we have data available, this is across the United States from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the suicide rate, not just attempts, the actual suicide rate among girls 10 to 14 had gone up 76%, whereas it had stayed level in boys. And the age at which people get depressed is dropping, especially for girls, so that almost a majority of young women are now becoming depressed before the age of 20. Mm. So something must be driving this other than biology and genes. All of these conditions have genetic origins. Some people are at more risk than others. But we wouldn't see such dramatic increases in the rates of or the drops in the age of onset of these problems unless there were something in the environment pushing the genetic envelope, if you were.
Yeah. When we speak of depression, we often speak of genetics and the brain. What role does culture play? What role does the environment play?
So so there's a couple of ways to answer that. We can calculate a statistic called heritability, and this is talked about in the media to some extent, which is not, well, I'm a certain height, what component of that is genetic, which is environmental? That's a meaningless question. My height, your depression, all of those in an individual are all genes and all environment. That's really sort of a nonsensical statistic. But we can say, why am I a certain height and why are some people taller or shorter? Why do some people get depressed and others not? Are the differences between people largely genetic differences? Or are they largely environmental differences? So we know, for example, that schizophrenia, a very serious mental disorder, is about 60% genetic or heritable. The reason why about 1% of the population gets schizophrenia and the rest don't, mainly are genetic reasons. For bipolar disorder, ADHD, that goes up to almost 80%. Now, for depression, the heritability is about 30% for men and 40% for women. So genes have something to do with why some people get serious depressions and others don't. But actually, environments have more to do with that. And finally, even for conditions that are very highly heritable, we might see changes in the rates of these conditions across the whole population because of environment. So what am I talking about? We're all 3 inches taller than our great-grandparents were a century ago. Is that because our genes have mutated? No, that would take many more than three generations to do that. It's something about, in this case, fat and hormone and protein content in our diet. So even conditions that are like mental health conditions that have at least some genetic liability, the environment may make those genes switch on earlier and earlier across everybody. So it's really not anymore nature versus nurture. It's how nature and nurture combine in sometimes very healthy and helpful ways, but in this case are combining to up the ante for very serious mental health problems in girls at precisely the same time. I think we could say it's the best time in history to be a teenage girl. Look at all the opportunities out there.
Yeah. In the book, you say, you know, some folks might be wondering, what's all the fuss about? Girls, especially middle-class girls, you say, you know, have been playing soccer, striving for the Ivies, and planning their career for more than two decades. But you also say what we're seeing right now is a runaway train. That's the metaphor you use.
That's right.
I'm sorry.
Well, I was going to say there's another metaphor, which is, what if we, and I'm not advocating this as an ethical experiment one would do, but what if we put a group of teenage kids, let's talk about girls, in a large room, but we sealed the room tight and pumped it full of cigarette smoke for 24 hours. Now, those kids who had the genetic liability for lung cancer, emphysema, would be those for whom that smoke-filled environment push them over the top. They'd be the first ones to show signs of these serious disorders. All kids, however, would get distressed. They'd be coughing and have red eyes. So if the triple bind is something in the environment, it's not smoke, but it's somehow toxic in a more psychological way, those kids who grew up in families where there's a big history of depression, and we know, again, genes have something to do with that, or have early risk for other conditions, they would be the ones to succumb to this environmental toxicity, if you will, earlier. But no kid is really going to remain unscathed because the pressures to be relentlessly perfect, to do it all so well, so quickly, first time, every time, even for kids who escape the serious mental health problems we're talking about, it's not leading to a healthy identity, and it may promote, as these kids now become parents, further pressure that's not aiming to achieve a healthy identity, but creating false selves and putting kids at risk for several generations to come.
Mm. Do the 75% of girls who are not at risk feel the triple bind? How?
Well, they feel it in ways that we did interviews and focus groups for this book, and there's certainly other writings about this. What are they saying, and what did we surmise? Number one, we still raise our daughters to be tomorrow's caregivers and nurturers. That's nothing new. Women of our species and most primate species are are the ones that really do the primary child rearing, even though we've made some changes in this. Number two, however, we've really got to raise our daughters to be competitive, athletically and academically. They're doing better than boys now at getting bachelor's degrees and master's degrees. Almost 60% of master's degrees in America go to women now, 57% of bachelor's degrees. Athletic scholarships, not really heard of back in my day in high school, are being awarded to girls. So girls have to be raised to be really top-notch, athletically and academically. So that would be a double bind. How can you be, to quote maybe one of the cuter lines from the triple bind, how can you be best friends forever and at the top of your class? That's tough to be that nurturant and that ruthlessly competitive simultaneously. Maybe that's not brand new. Maybe for a generation or so, that bind girls have been in. What makes this so difficult today is the third prong of the triple bind. What girls are telling us is we've got to be perfect in every way. A's aren't good enough. It's A pluses. It's AP classes. Can't play a variety of sports. It's got to be one sport so you're perfect in it. And not letting anyone know that you're sweating and having to do all this in a relentlessly ultra-feminized or sexualized way. Even the alternative role models, athletes, rock singers among women today, often are fashion models or designers or look like them or are posing in magazines provocatively. So how can you be relentlessly nurturing, relentlessly competitive, and do so effortlessly in a very sexualized way without sacrificing your true identity or without literally not having enough sleep? The pressure is on, and mental health problems are rising, as we said, quite precipitously as a side effect of these great opportunities.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, psychologist Stephen Hinshaw. He's the author of The Triple Bind, Saving Our Teenage Girls from Today's Pressures. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and 800-222-WILL. You begin the book with a description of a Disney movie. I have not seen this movie. That's a modern-day princess story. The film is Enchanted. Would you tell our listeners about the movie's storyline and why you chose to begin The Triple Bind with a description of this film?
Well, what it does, metaphorically and on screen, is show how impossible it really is to fulfill the roles we have for young women today. That can you be the career girl, if you will, and a loving wife, and be fashion model-like in your looks without sacrificing something and without getting into all the details of the storyline, which is, of course, a fantasy. It's a play. It's a show. It's a movie. Mm-hmm. It was a book. It's saying that something really has to give, and maybe one can live happily ever after in the film, but it comes at the sacrifice of who am I really going to be? One of the sad things that many girls that we interviewed in focus groups for this book said was something to the effect of, well, we don't really even speak up much in our high school classes. Well, wait a minute, interviewers would say, you're doing better than boys in many ways. Why would you speak up? You're verbal, you're girls. Well, if we don't get the answer right the first time, we're graded lower for our participation part of the grade. And to me, this is chilling. What's the real task of adolescence? To form an identity, to know who you are in this world, what you want to be, how you want to do it. If we're going to do that, if there's going to be real self-discovery, you've got to try some things you're not great at. You've got to fall on your face sometimes. It's okay to have some downtime, think and dream and explore, see nature. But if it's no, you've got to be right the first time, every time, God forbid you'd have a wrong answer or that you wouldn't look perfect, that kind of pressure. It's not just a matter of scheduling. This book's written on the overscheduled child. Scheduling is not the culprit here. It's the relentless pressure to be perfect in body, in looks, in behavior, do this effortlessly, that doesn't allow the opportunity to get through the main task of the teen years, which is to figure out your place in the world. And so people, psychologists talk about a false self. I'm living to please others all the time. I've kind of forgotten what my own goals are. One of the interesting things in terms of research that the Triple Bind discusses is, think of girls again before the teen years. More than boys, they're verbal. They care more what adults think. They're more compliant. They play even in the preschool years in smaller, more intimate social groups. These are all protective factors, we say. They protect girls against having attention problems, autistic disorder, aggressive conduct problems. But those very same skills and protective factors, being very verbal, very compliant, very empathic, for a girl in her teen years who's got a distressed family, who's got other problems, those same things that protected her 10 years ago now actually create higher risk for hurting herself or becoming depressed. So the very skills girls have, once the pressures of the teen years come on, and once the hormones of puberty start to switch on genes up in the brain that may make us at more risk for things like depression, things get turned on their heads. So it's fine, obviously, for girls to have these great opportunities today, but the ways we intentionally and often non-intentionally as adults are putting relentless pressure to do this so well without any crack or without any thought that it might take a lot of time and a lot of false starts and false leads before this identity forms. This is where girls who don't even know quite how they're feeling about all this will take out that pain through serious ways of harming themselves.
Mm-hmm. They're likely to turn that anger and that upset inward.
That's right. And they might turn, for example, the empathy they have naturally more than boys and the verbal skills they have more than our boys who, even in the preschool years again, are speaking in shorter phrases and girls in full sentences. They might turn that empathy to help the distressed mom or the friend in need. But somehow along the way, they've neglected to really assert and care for themselves. Then the distress ensues. They know they're upset. They're good at examining their feelings. And something called rumination, going over and over something you haven't done perfectly well. Rumination, this repetitive thinking, is a strong risk factor for depression in girls. And girls, being naturally more verbal, more empathic, caring more what other people think, tend to ruminate more than boys, which can set the stage for a spiral of depression or suicide or self-harm.
Mm. So how do we look behind what you call the mask of cheerful obedience?
Well, it's not easy to do as a parent, for example. Right at that time, I'm trying to figure out, somewhat tongue-in-cheek, the exact years at which our young teens would rather be caught dead than with a parent. You've got to drop them two blocks from the theater to meet friends. They'd rather do anything than be seen in a car, their silhouette with a parental figure. So, but at the same time, kids this age are begging for contact. They want to be talked with honestly and openly, not just valued for their grades, their looks, etc. So how does a parent really look behind and beyond? Not often easy to distinguish normal teenage strife and stress from some of the signs of mental health problems we're talking about. But certainly, if you see excessive dieting, becoming a vegan when there was no sign of that before, nothing wrong with that, compulsive exercising, even worse, the scratch or cut or burn marks maybe hidden by the long sweatshirt sleeves. These are signs of needing to be perfect, not being able to express through words some deep pain. Again, not just being sad and irritable, that comes with it, but several weeks running maybe now months running of loss of pleasurable interest in the things that usually are exciting, talk that life really isn't worth living. These signs of eating problems, self-harm, depression, this is when we need to get ourselves, our families, our kids into mental health treatment that has a good fighting chance of making a significant improvement. But again, we won't do anything about this if we don't talk about and recognize that mental health problems are sadly in great numbers, accompanying the great opportunities and pressures girls are under. Mm.
You mentioned that time in life where, you know, you want parents to you know, be two blocks ahead of you or behind you, but nowhere near. Well, that's public. What about at home where no one's watching? Because that's got to be really critical. Aside of looking for, you know, recognizing signs of trouble, what advice do you have for building stronger relationships? Because sometimes I think that there's a girl in the book, The Triple Bind, that you quote, who said something like, I just fall apart when an adult says, I'm so disappointed in you.
That's right.
And on the one hand, you think when you say something like that, that you're acknowledging the strengths of a child on the one hand, you know, because you're saying, you know, you're better than that.
That's right. I think I'm now hearing the question, and it's a subtle but very important one. A couple of things come to mind. It's not just an urban myth. The research shows families who take the time and trouble to have meals together several times a week or more, this is a protective factor. These are kids who are at lower risk for substance abuse, depression, self-harm, acting out in some way. Again, even though overtly it's, I don't want to be with my family, it's only my friends, I don't want to be caught dead anywhere near my parents, but at home, these kids are by and large begging for contact, real discussions. This is a good time also to teach critical thinking skills about the media. Does every girl or young woman have to look like that kind of a model? What's an ad? What's a news story? And at the same time, even though kids are in some ways pushing us away as parents at that time, they're seeing what we do more than what we say. How concerned are we with our own body image or with relentless success? Not with feelings, not with downtime. Kids who perceive that their parents are relentlessly critical about who they are, voicing disappointment because of a lack of achievement, not seeing the kid, the real kid, and the struggles behind it, this is another big risk factor for alienation, depression, self-harm, even aggressive behavior. So it's fine to have high expectations for our kids. I mean, kids need that. It's fine to push them to do things. Often in the early teen years, there's a kind of lethargy and no homework. But if it's a devastation with an utter disappointment in, you're not fulfilling some ideal, then you're not being viewed as a kid with your own wants and needs, but you're being viewed as someone who's got to fulfill maybe some of the unfulfilled wishes of the parent. That kind of alienation leads to real shutdown in communication and, in many cases, to this deep emotional pain that kids can't express in any other way but to harm themselves.
Mm-hmm. Also, it would seem that, and this goes back to something you said earlier, to be clear that it's okay to try things and you're not going to be good at everything.
That's right.
But you won't know what you like and who you are unless you try it out.
If the goal of adolescence is to form a viable identity, to really self-discover, I don't know anybody who can do that by having to be perfect first time and every time in everything they try, unless there's some sort of predestination, some unfolding from the part of the self that knew what it wanted beforehand. It just doesn't happen that way. Downtime, walks in nature, not always having to be on, trying something you're not very good at, learning gee, I kind of thought it was fun, I'll get better at it, or that's not for me. That's the goal with childhood and adolescence. Again, it's fine to have high expectations, and we want our girls to succeed academically and athletically, but if it's the relentless pursuit of perfection that doesn't allow for that genuine exploration and discovery, then we're really foreclosing futures, not opening futures up to our kids.
Mm. One of the aspects of our culture that's problematic for girls and boys that you list early in the Triple Bind, I thought was very interesting. Loss of community.
Yes. So let's think about this. And I'm going to start with a particular research study. And you may think, well, where am I going? But bear with me, because I think it's quite important. This is a study done by Barbara Fredrickson, a professor of psychology at University of North Carolina. Used to be a postdoc with us at Berkeley, went on to Michigan for a time. And at Michigan, she published a decade ago the now infamous swimsuit study. It's been replicated by others. In a nutshell, as all social psychologists who sometimes do devious things to undergraduates to prove psychological points, Fredrickson had the students in the Psych 1 intro classes, et cetera, come in to get research credits, and men and women, all one-on-one, no one else in the room, you're just alone in a room, doing some very difficult math problems for not even an hour with just a study desk and a mirror in the room. And here was the experimental assignment or condition. Do you do this wearing a sweater and trousers, or do you do it wearing a bathing suit? And for the young women, it was a one-piece bathing suit. It wasn't a bikini. And that was the random assignment. So half the men and half the women did the hard math problems in regular clothes and half in a bathing suit, alone in a room with a mirror. What were the findings? The young men felt the emotions of some a little giddiness and a little pride, maybe a touch of embarrassment, and did better on the math problems in the bathing suit than in the clothes. The young women felt some humiliation and shame and real embarrassment and did far worse on the math problems. This is a few minutes alone in a room with a mirror and nobody else. This is sexual objectification, the bathing suit exposing skin. This is how you're supposed to look. That took away the young women's cognitive resources. They didn't have much left to concentrate on hard math problems. Mm. So the Triple Bind in some ways is like this mirror in that room. I'm self-focused. I have to look and be a certain way, and for women that can be paralyzing. One of the true antidotes to the Triple Bind, now getting to your question, is what if we could, and especially today, given the economic downturn, given the crises in each community around the nation, around the world, could foster a sense of wider world out there, community involvement or action or volunteerism, not to put one more piece on your resume to get into the best college, but because of some exposure to others with difficult problems, empathy in a true sense for how to help. Maybe that would take the mirror gaze away and stop some of this relentless self-focus that, again, if Fredrickson showed it in a few short minutes in an experimental social psych study, what if you're exposed 24/7 in today's cyberculture to images of how women are supposed to look, replays of what was said back in social studies, third period, pictures, Facebook, MySpace, that you can never really escape from. Mm-hmm. This relentless mirror is robbing identities or creating false selves. A wider connection with community may be a real antidote.
Yeah. Tell us now about a girl you call Lily Gordon.
That's right. And this is really Lily Gordon. Some of the girls in the Triple Bind are composites putting together. And Lily is a 15-year-old who lives just down the road from me here in Berkeley. Whose mom is a colleague of mine at the university, and it was a little over a decade ago that Laura, her mom, said Steve, you do some work in attention deficit, and Lily here now, toddler, preschooler, she's something. She's hell on wheels. Maybe we've got to evaluate her. Maybe we'll need medication. She's really intense. It's hard for her to focus. So there was real clinical concern, and her mom's a psychologist like me. Now, fast forwarding, a few years ago, when Lily was right at that sort of tween age, some students at her school were doing some fundraising for benefit, and there was some both local and international concerns. And she, competitive one that she was, said, well, I can raise money too. And she got interested in one of the causes, which was in many communities in Africa where there's utter poverty, while there's HIV, ravage of communities, and made her first visit at age 11, if I've got it right, over to Africa for part of a summer, has gone every summer since, has done much more fundraising, and this has changed her life. She now knows that some of the concerns that she and her other early high schoolers have are kind of petty when you take into consideration how devastating other people's lives are. She feels a deep sense of gratitude and purpose in the fundraising and the community work she does, and it provides a healthy perspective against the peer pressures, and she's a good athlete, basketball and soccer, but it helps her keep things in perspective rather than every single thing I do gets exaggerated, distorted because of this relentless comparison and media images out there. And I think it's a great example of what a wider sense of connection with community and the world can do as a real antidote to the triple bind. Mm.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Stephen Hinshaw. He is the author of The Triple Bind. Be pretty, sweet, and nice. That's number one. Number two, be athletic, be competitive, and get straight A's. And three, be impossibly perfect. The Triple Bind, saving our teenage girls from today's pressures. That's what we're talking about here this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. What are your thoughts? 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-9455. WILL. Families today are working really hard, and there's so many pressures throughout the family on everybody in the family. Everybody is working, whether they are working at a job or a couple of jobs, or whether they're working on their homework and getting into school or figuring out what they're going to do with their lives and so on and so forth. Is there a way out of that?
Well, even in the year or so since the writing of The Triple Bind was finished and just published a couple of months ago, the country's taken a huge economic downturn. So many of the things we anticipated in The Triple Bind have come home to roost even more dramatically than might have even anticipated. So The Triple Bind is not saying, hey, we don't need to work anymore. We've got to work harder than ever.
Yeah.
But it's how we do it. And parents know how hard it is to get into the top schools, how many jobs are getting outsourced. What does it really take? And ultimately what it takes is clearly some economic solutions at a national and international level, but it also takes working out of a sense of commitment for jobs that really matter, for purposes that really matter, and I can't solve the structural global economic problems, but what I can say is that kids pick up on not only what parents and teachers and neighbors say, but how they're doing it and what they do. And if kids are noticing it's all about the image, it's about the trappings of success, it's about what's on my resume to get to the next point, but somehow that deeper sense of purpose we just talked about, that connection, that real commitment isn't there, that's hardly a way to form an identity that's going to last. And there's a lot of pain in there. There's a lot of striving. Is anyone noticing how hard I'm trying? There's a lot of distress in the world, and there are mental health problems, and there's now economic problems more than ever. When kids don't have a way to express that pain, There's a fancy psychological term, alexithymia, A-L-E-X-I, thymia. When you're feeling some emotion deep inside, but you can't put it into words, there's no way of expressing it, this is thought to be one of the core issues underlying eating disorders, self-destructive, self-harmful cutting, self-mutilatory behavior. There's a conflict, there's pain, I can't express it, but maybe I could feel it literally by watching blood ooze or by seeing the pounds pour off my body, feeling the pain in a physical, if not an emotional way. And so how to connect this back to the economic issues and the wider issues? If we're doing it rotely and we're doing this work joylessly without a sense of deeper connection with ourselves and the world, we're probably setting the stage for this disconnect between action and feeling that's at the root of so many of these mental health problems our teenage daughters are facing.
Hmm. The other day I saw someone, a young man, he had on a wireless telephone. He was also, in one ear, he had an earbud connected to an iPod, and he was pumping gas. And I thought, wow, that's multitasking.
Are we talking multitasking?
Or what? So we're all wired up, and we can't just do one thing. If we're walking to school, we're listening to music, or we're talking on the phone, so on and so forth. What are your thoughts on that?
How did we get here?
How did we get here, and how do we put that into, you know, how do we calm down, I guess is what I'm trying to ask.
Well, I have a couple of thoughts and reactions, and there's a lot of research being done on this topic. Now, some multitasking is not a bad thing. Sometimes, it depends on the individual person. Listening to music while doing something else can be relaxing, and you're kind of listening with that third ear and getting homework done or work done. But how are you simultaneously instant messaging and responding to email and doing your homework online while rock music is playing? That's a lot of channels of input right now.
Mm-hmm.
We know from important research, both on people's behaviors and even looking at brain mechanisms with image and neuroimaging studies, that multitasking, trying to learn something while you're doing something else, intriguingly, people can learn to do that okay. They can get the information in while focusing on tones or trying to remember other things. But the next day, an hour later, a day later, a week later, when you're trying to use that information you were supposed to be learning and put it into use, that's where the problems begin, because it didn't get processed at a deep enough level.
Mm.
So it's really the output later on that gets compromised. Then with the graphic example you gave and others we can all think of the stress mentally to try to maintain that many channels, and in an issue that the triple bind discusses at some length, think if you're doing that 10 o'clock at night, midnight, 2 a.m., can't shut off the wireless, can't really get out of your mind the images, again, the discussion back in social studies third period in which you said something that's now being broadcast everywhere. How many hundreds of images a day does any teen see of how women are supposed to look? This constant barrage of images that you can't shut off. Now, into the nighttime, we've lost track of natural daylight. I mean, of course, with the electric light and Edison over a century ago, that got us into this era. But sleep deprivation is another part of the triple bind. Mm. Just at the time when a lot of sleep is really needed in adolescence, not only to consolidate what we've learned into long-term memory, but also to regulate our negative emotions. The most recent research by my colleague Matt Walker, just down the hallway from me at UC Berkeley, shows that when you're dramatically sleep deprived, not only do you learn material less well, but at the level of inside your brain, our frontal lobes don't really shut down the messages from deep inside our brain, the amygdala, that sort of primitive center of the brain that processes negative emotions and fear stimuli. So we can't regulate our emotions very well. Well, we all kind of know, incidentally, that we get cranky when we're somewhat sleep-deprived. Mm-hmm. But what if you're sleep-deprived day after day, doing so many tasks, having so much pressure with so many images? That's now compounding the risk that we're talking about, because sleep deprivation is a risk factor not only for emotion dysregulation, but for some of the mental health problems that we're talking about, like depression.
Mm. Let's take a call. A listener is waiting to talk with us in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
Good. It seems to me that most of your conversation is applicable to a person, young lady, that is college-bound, highly successful, soccer, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Let's go to the other end of the spectrum, to a kid that's in a low-class socioeconomic status with a dysfunctional family that's thinking about dropping out of school. It's got a few tattoos and a few piercings, bright enough, but just sort of turns off on the world. What do you comment about that girl?
Well, I'm glad you raised this, because the triple bind is not solely a phenomenon of upper-middle-class white suburban girls. We know, for example, forgetting the triple bind for a minute, but just at the level of epidemiology and the distribution across our society of mental health problems, that with the possible exception of bipolar illness, manic depressive illness, which tends to cluster among higher social classes, every condition we're talking about, interpersonal aggression and violence, depression, suicide, is correlated with lower social class. Poverty is a risk factor for all of these conditions. So stereotypically, yeah, it's the suburban kids who have all these pressures, but think of the other kinds of pressures that poorer kids have. Remember, poorer kids have more opportunity now to get into the top private schools because they get the financial aid packages that some middle-class kids don't. They're bright, too, if they can get turned on to learning, but they have to often support families by working jobs earlier than suburban kids do. Their parents are working multiple jobs just to get by. So I'm glad you raised this, because it's not just the stereotypic upper-middle-class kid. Everybody's feeling these pressures. And now some ethnic groups, some suggestion that among African American teens, there's not the sort of buy-in to the relentlessly thin, hot, sexy look that girls have, and they may be at somewhat protected status against eating disorders. But depression, violence, and these problems are rising across the ethnic and socioeconomic spectra today. And my suspicion is that the triple bind is showing its teeth for kids across the board. Maybe the next book, The Daughter of the Triple Bind, if you will look more both cross-ethnically and internationally to see if we're finding similar increases in these problems outside the U.S. as well. Mm-hmm. So great question.
Yeah, I want to thank the listener for calling. Did you want to follow up?
Yeah, how do you help that young person who is in that situation to realize that I might be able to get a college education less expensively or whatever and get back on track rather than saying I'm going to drop out of school?
Yeah, I wish I had the answer to that question. It's a tough one. It has to do with families and learning opportunities. Sometimes it even has to do with nutrition. It has to do with health conditions, neighborhoods where people live, and it has to do with responsive schools that value the learning of all kids. And, boy, it's worth it when you see the spark in that kid's eye, even the kid at high risk, as you're talking about, who realizes, I'm good at sports, I'm good, I like this topic, I'm good academically. And when you can light that fire and get some good things going, there's no stopping them. But it's an uphill battle the more risk factors of poverty you have. So I think it's a tough struggle.
Good enough. Thank you.
Thanks
for the call this afternoon. We've got to wrap it up now. I'm wondering, is the triple bind something that others in the field of psychology, psychiatry are recognizing?
Well, the double bind was a hypothesis from about 50 years ago now,
mm-hmm.
that certain families were providing one set of messages with their words and another nonverbally, putting kids in an impossible situation that was a cause of schizophrenia. Catchy title, The Double Bind. Not a shred of evidence that it really causes schizophrenia. So The Triple Bind is taking metaphorically this idea of impossible binds, but not in terms of schizophrenia, in terms of the conditions we're talking about, into today's culture, the need to be nurturing and super competitive and super sexy and effortlessly doing all this. It's a hypothesis. No one in our research group or others has yet put to the test, if you get all three components of the triple bind, is that the cause of this rise? But the more I talk academically, the more I talk to both lay and, more intellectually bound academic audiences, it's resonating with what we know about the risk and protective factors for mental health problems, and I hope we see a spate of research to see not only are we on the right track here in terms of understanding the causes of these problems, but can we start to do something about it?
Thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
I really appreciate the opportunity.
My pleasure. Stephen Hinshaw chairs the Department of Psychology at the University of California, Berkeley. He is the author, together with Rachel Kranz, of the book The Triple Bind, Saving Our Teenage Girls from Today's Pressures. The book is published by Valentine Books.
You've been listening to an archive edition of Illinois Public Media's Afternoon Magazine with your host, Celeste Quinn. I'm Todd Gleason in the WILL studios at AM 580 here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. Coming up on the hour of 2 o'clock in just about 7 minutes, time now to check what happened in Chicago at the Board of Trade in the soft red winter wheat pit this afternoon. Futures finished the day lower, down 4¾ cents. 454 was the high price for the day. The low in that lead option was at 445.5, and a settlement price at 452¾ managed to settle the soft red winter wheat down 4¾ cents. March futures, 474 the high. The low at 466, a settlement price this afternoon at 472.5, down 4.5, and May contract 485¼ the high. Low at 478¾, settlement price at 484¾, down 4.5 cents. July futures, 498, the high, the low at 88¾, settlement price at 496¾, down 6.5. And the September soft red winter wheat futures, 511¼, the high, the low at 506¼, settlement price at 510¾, down 8 cents on the afternoon. In Kansas City, nearby December hard red winter wheat futures finished 7 cents lower at 469½ cents. Back in Chicago now from the corn pit. December contract at 340.5, settlement price. The lead option had a high of 346, a low at $3.37.5. December futures, the harvest month at 340.5, settlement price down 3.5 cents. March contract 358.5, the high, the low at 350. March corn settled 353¼, down 3.5. In the May futures, 367, the high. The low at $3.59¼, settlement price at $3.62, down 3¾. July futures, $3.75 the high, the low at $67¼. Settlement price this afternoon at $3.70¼, down 3½. And September futures, $3.82 the high, the low at $76. Settlement price at $3.78½, finished 3¼. Next year's December futures, $3.89. The settlement price was down 3¾ with a high of 394 and a low at 386¼. Settlement price again at 389, down 3¾. That for the December 2010 corn contract. December oats today 9 cents lower at 224. The March at 237.5, down 9 as well. From the soy complex now, nearby November soybeans, the harvest month 9 cents lower there as well. 932¾ the high. Low at 14¾, settlement price at $9.18. November beans down 9. January futures, 938.5, the high, the low at 920¾. Settlement price at 924¼, down 9¼. And the March contract at 937 top. Bottom at 921, settlement price at $9.24¾, down 8¾. May futures, 932¾, the high, the low at 16. Settlement price at 920¾, down 7¼. And July soybeans, 9.33 the high, the low at 16.5. A settlement price at $9.21.5, down 7.5. Next year's November beans for 2010, a 9.10 top, bottom at $8.97. Settlement price at $9.03.5, finished a half cent lower on the afternoon. From the bean meal pit, October contract today had a high price of $289.50 a ton, a low at $283.40, with a settlement price down $4 at $284.70. December bean meal futures, $286.70, the high, the low at $279.80. Settlement price at $280.80, down $4.70. October soybean oil, $34.55, the high, the low at $33.88. Settlement price at $34.25, 28 higher on the afternoon. And December soybean oil, $34.90 the high, the low at $34.20. Settlement price at $34.59, finished 26 cents higher. During the closing market report this afternoon, I'll talk with Dan Zwicker of ADM Grain Group. He's out of Decatur, Illinois. That comes up at 6 after the hour. We'll take up not only the grains, but we'll take a look at the livestock then as well. Speaking of which, from the CME Group's livestock side, futures finished down $1.50 in the nearby October contract for the live cattle. 85.45 was the high there today. The low at 84.05 with the settlement price at $84.10 for 100 weight. That's 100 pounds, down $1.50. December futures, $86.05 the high. The low at 84.75 with settlement price at 84.97.5. December live cattle down $1.15. And the February futures, 86.45 the high. The low at 85.25. Settlement price at $85.32.5, down $1.05. April futures, $88.45 the high, the low at $87.32.5, settled at $87.47.5, down $1.20. Feeder cattle now, October contract, $96.15 the high, the low there at $94.90, and a settlement price at $94.95, down $1.55. November's $96.40 the high, the low at $94.85. Settled 94.92.5, down $1.70 in the January futures, 97.20 the high, the low at 95.40. Settled 95.87.5, down $1.62.5. The March feeders, 97.80 the high, the low at 96.30. Settlement price at 96.85, down $1.05. October lean hog futures, $50 the high, the low at 48.90. Settlement price at $49.42.5, down 65 cents. December futures at $49.60 top, bottom at $48.30. Settled 48.62.5, 97.5 cents lower. February futures, $56.90 the high, the low at $55.80. Settlement price at $56.02.5, down 87.5 cents in the April futures, $62 the high, the low at $60.70, and a settlement price for the April lean hogs at $61.17.5, down 72.5 cents. Pork bellies now, February contract on the afternoon, $82.90 the high, the low at $80.60, settlement price at $81.25, down 45 in the March bellies, $80 even, down 40 cents. Once again, during the closing market report, we'll take a closer look at the livestock sector, especially pork production. Chris Hurt will join us this afternoon from Purdue Extension.
Support for Illinois Public Media comes from Syngenta, featuring AgriSure 3000 GT hybrids, designed to give you up to 38 bushels more per acre if you have rootworms, and an average of 3 more even if you don't. More information on Syngenta's AgriSure 3000 GT hybrids is at agrisuretraits.com.
Here's what the weather forecast for the two-state region looks like from our own meteorologist, Daniel Pounder. He says tonight in western Illinois, skies should be cloudy. It'll rain, some thunderstorms early, and then becoming partly cloudy. In eastern Illinois, mostly cloudy, showers, a few thunderstorms. Those will happen mostly before midnight. In Indiana, cloudy periods of rain, some thunderstorms as well. Lows will range from 44 in northwestern Illinois to